been an incident here. Did you see what happened?
Yeah, I actually saw it. They threw a chair at my brother. You know, it's not our fault that we get out of the gym and we work hard. We train hard and we believe in ourselves.
Are you okay?
I'm good. Is he okay?
Let's talk about the fight now.
Is you okay?
No, let's talk about the fight now.
Let's talk.
Okay.
Let's talk.
It was much quicker.
They was giving him a lot of attention, running around with cameras. They was all this other BS and all that. I was quiet the whole time. Hey, coach, tell him to read your shirt, coach. Read your shirt.
Keep running your mouth. Okay. Well, you had the final say here, but it got pretty personal even at the press conference, didn't it?
That's not my fault. I was cool. I was chilling.
Welcome back, Simon. You're back on the podcast, and we are going to get right into things. But, well, before we do, make sure you leave a rating, make sure you leave a review, you subscribe, you do whatever, all that sharing stuff, that social media stuff, you make sure you do that, okay? If you're listening to this, you probably have a better grasp of that stuff than me. I don't know about Simon. Simon, what do you think?
Leaving reviews and ratings and stuff.
Yep.
I'm really terrible at that. I don't actually listen to any podcasts. I don't have a Facebook account. I don't use Twitter. It's all kind of alien to me.
Okay, so you're going to have to tell us your criminal record, because that's basically what you're telling us.
No, not at all. It's none of that really interests me, but if that's your thing, that's your thing. So it's all kind of alien to me with the, leave a share and a comment and a whatever. That's all kind of odd to me.
Okay, well, either you're very awkward or you have a criminal record. Let's go with you have a criminal record.
Or both. We can do both.
Okay, let's start with the, I thought was perhaps, well, indeed it was the most competitive fight on paper going into the weekend. It was the fight that everybody was talking about. No, not Laura Gachet, but we'll get to that later. It was,
if we have to,
Jermell Charlo versus Erickson Lubin. So what we had was one half of the most hated set of twins in boxing versus the number one American prospect in the world. And the first question, and what I want to address immediately is, was this too early for Lubin? And I'll say my piece, Simon, and then you can give your piece. Hopefully you disagree.
All right.
But I think it was too early, absolutely too early for Lubin to be fighting a guy like Charlo. And so Lubin was coming in, and he had the resume, the wins on his record that were the wins that you would have. The guys that Charlo's beaten that make up Charlo's resume, they've also beaten those guys. So the level of opposition, the difference between what Lubin's been able to do in his career and what Jermell Charlo's been able to do, there's a huge gap there. And I saw that. I tried to point it out on the podcast last week, but I'm not going to say I saw KO1. I didn't. But I knew that Charlo had way too much experience for Lubin, and if Lubin was going to win, it would be him really rising to the occasion. So, you just bring the size together, the experience, all that. I think it was too early for Lubin, and I don't want to say I don't want to say it's all too early, but you can go on and give your share of that answer or your take on that.
Yeah, I texted you just after the fight saying it was just a bit too green. And I think one thing with...
I thought you were talking about your weed.
No, I'm not. I don't partake. But I think with first round stoppages, with explosive stoppages, it sometimes can give people the impression that it's kind of like super one-sided blowout. And I don't think that's what we saw. I think that it was an awkward shot that caught him wrong. Basically what I'm saying is if they did it again in a few weeks' time, I don't think that he'd get caught with that sort of shot. I think that he's going to learn a lot from it. I don't think that he got brutally outclassed or anything. It's just the difference in skill meant that he was able to get a veteran shot off that he perhaps should have responded to better and not allowed himself to be caught in such a way. Hopefully he learns from it. But I didn't see it as one of those losses that's necessarily going to destroy someone's career, break their confidence. I think it can happen to anyone, and it happened to him.
Yeah, and that's a really good point, because I think if you look at the way it happened and everything, it's absolutely one of those moments where Lubin is not going to be destroyed from this. I can see him justifying it to himself as he got hit with a lucky shot. If you look at the positioning and everything, it looks lucky from the Lubin supporter side. Now,
I don't think that you can say luck. It was well crafted. He got caught in a trap and hit with something that he probably shouldn't have. you know, was there an element of luck to it? Maybe, but it was definitely skill that allowed that to happen.
No, I'm not going to say that. I'm just saying, for if you were in the Lubin camp, you can easily see that justification, and you can frame it that way and be okay with that. Now, for me, I think Jermell Charlo deserves all the credit here, because you can see that Charlo was deliberate with what he did, and he had figured out, and it's actually a shock if you really think about it. Tons of fighters do what Erickson Lubin does, you know, bending at the waist and using that as your defense, where you're basically either caught in a clinch or just you can't hit because you can't punch that low. And that's what Lubin was doing, and we see tons of fighters do it. And Charlo knew where he was going and met him with the right uppercut. And, you know, it's good, because I think that thing happening where somebody sees you can counter that and win a fight by basically stopping a fighter from doing that, it's going to put a stop to a lot of these ugly fights, because there are a ton of ugly fights that take place where it, you know, it becomes ugly because one guy's bending at the waist all the time.
Do you think it could be transformative in the sense that other people start using it to counter that style? Is that what you're getting at?
That's exactly what I'm getting at. And again, I want to, while I, you know, I don't want to get too off into the hyperbole of that, I do want to just give credit to Jermell Charlo that what he did, it reminded me of seeing a great quarterback like Aaron Rodgers, who just went down this weekend. But you live in Houston, Simon, so I'll use Deshaun Watson. He ain't great, but in college he was. But I like Deshaun Watson, just, you know, for Houston fans listening, I'm a fan of Deshaun Watson. I think he's going to be good. Simon, I know you watch Deshaun with a keen eye every Sunday.
You know I don't follow any of the sports but boxing.
Simon, you want to get thrown out of Texas? Take that back.
I don't know. That's not been my experience here. I mean, people are big on it, of course.
That's because nobody knows your name, and you don't leave your house because you have a criminal record. There's warrants out for your arrest. But look, it was like a quarterback, great quarterback. You want to talk about profiling, but a great quarterback can throw the ball to where he wants his receiver to be and make make a play where there wasn't a play. Like, a normal quarterback isn't going to make a play out of a certain thing because they're going to say, like, you know, he's not open, so I'm not going to throw it. But a great receiver can see that opening where just the right spot where they can put the ball where the defender can't get it and the receiver can get to it. And that's what Jermell Charlo did. He saw where Lubin was going and put his fist where Lubin was going to be and ended him. And I just thought it was brilliant to see somebody finally do that, because there's been so many times where I watch tons of fights and guys spend half of the fight bending down, trying to get out of the way, and it's ugly to watch. And I hope more people take this and see that, so we can see a different type of, you know, actual defense, you know, like blocking punches or slipping or something and not just bending down.
Yeah, I don't necessarily have your faith about how transformative it's going to be, but it's an interesting take. My main take is the kind of, like, commiserations to Lubin. You got caught with a good one. Hopefully he can go away and learn from it and come back better.
I absolutely think he will. But I don't want to spend too much time on talking about where Lubin's going to go here, because it's pretty obvious. He's going to rebuild, and he's going to get right back into the title picture. I think he needs a few tough fights that are below the Charlo level for sure. I think, you know, you need to put him in with the guy like, we're going to go over some of the guys actually that I think that might be good for him, and we can do it together. So I just wanted to ask, you know, how far do you think Jermell Charlo could go? And just right off the bat, without mentioning any names, do you think he could be the number one guy at 154?
I mean, is there some controversial views on who that might be though?
No, it's very clear that right now it's Arislandi Lara, but I'm going to save that. Like, but do you think he has a potential, just on a yes or no question, to be the number one guy at 154?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. So now we're going to run through the names, and I want to see if you can back that up. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think the fight goes between Jermell Charlo and Demetrius Andrade, however he wants to say his name?
I don't know how good that is to watch, but I think that he wins a fairly one-sided decision.
Okay. I don't know that it's a fairly one-sided decision. What I will say is I think Demetrius Andrade, who we will talk about later, is pretty overrated. And the sentiment is going to continue to grow now that he's with HBO, but more on that later. Miguel Cotto.
I think we'll probably need to look and see how he looks in his upcoming fight, but all of the evidence would suggest that he's probably got his best years long behind him now, and that I don't think that he'd be able to stand up to a real live dog opponent like that.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one. I think Cotto's best years are
probably a stoppage there.
Yeah, for Jermell. I think Cotto's best years are not only behind him, but a few weight classes below this. Mm. And Jermell Charlo is a big 154-pound fighter. I mean, he's not like big like Julio Cesar Chavez Jr. big, but he's a guy that he uses every ounce that he has on his body. Liam Smith and Liam Williams, I'm going to say this. They are nothing more than domestic British fighters. You got a different opinion?
I think that's fair. Definitely more so on Williams than Smith. But even with Smith, I think that he's going to really struggle on the world stage just because of the level of competition is so high. I don't see him being competitive with some of the top names.
No, Simon. I'm not going to let you pass on that one, okay? Liam Smith was getting beat up by Liam Williams. Seriously?
That's what happens when you have like that mentality, I guess. You know, when you see someone that has attributes that suggest that they might belong on the world stage, but then they have something that lets them down, like ring IQ, for example, and they end up getting into these exchanges that they just really shouldn't. They should be better than, but they're not.
Okay, I see you just took a swing at Chris Eubank Jr. More on that later. Julian Williams. He's already got KO'd by his brother, but Jermell ain't Jermall. So Julian Williams, how does that go?
I don't know. I don't feel confident on picking that. I think probably way more competitive, though. Probably a Charlo stoppage, though.
Okay. Kanat Islam. I don't know if you know too much about this guy. He's
No, that's out of left field for me.
Kazakhstan. I don't think he's ready. He's 33 years old. That should tell you what you need to know. 33-year-old fighter. You haven't seen him yet. I mean, he's fought on a couple of PBC on bounce cards. And at one point was brought in based, if I'm remembering correctly, and I don't do the best preparation when I'm looking up this stuff, but I believe he was brought in to be like the opponent and ended up stopping the guy. And then I think he got brought back. They were like, okay, well, we like you. You know, we're going to take the winner and you won. Maciej Sulecki. Oh, and if you want to know, Charlo will stop him. Maciej Sulecki. Is this another left field one?
Yeah, not one that I can like confidently think about how I've like seen them fight.
I will say that he beat Hugo Centeno Jr. And Hugo Centeno is on coming off of the heels of a big knockout win over can't remember his name, but he was
just
undefeated
up their
prospect.
Record here, and it looks like they're kind of flirting with the world level. They might belong there, they might not, but the kind of facts remain to be seen there. Is that about fair?
Yeah. See, like, one of these guys is the guy that Lubin was supposed to be fighting this past Saturday. Not Jermell Charlo. And that brings us now to the last two guys, Jarrett Hurd and Arislan Di Lara. Let's start with Hurd first, and we're going to get more into these guys in depth. But just kind of touching on the fight.
Do you want to talk about that? Because I wasn't super impressed with that performance. I saw a lot of holes.
Well, here's what I'll say, okay? And we'll just get into it fully. So with Hurd, I think he loses the advantage. Like, in a fight with Charlo, I think what makes him look good and what has had him be successful to date in his career, he will not have that advantage against Jermell Charlo, and that's the size. And then with Lara, I don't really think anyone cares. So it's irrelevant to really talk about that fight, but...
I think you can make a good point there, and I think first I want to just say that, like,
Lara?
No, I'm going to be critical of Hurd as a world level fighter. He's still exceptionally good, loads of talent. He's no good, but the fight with Trout, I felt that he kind of threw lots of rounds he didn't need to be throwing, and I think that what it comes down to is, he had a lot of confidence in his power and ability to dictate the pace of the fight and that he'd be able to walk him down and get work done whenever he wanted. And largely that was true. But because of how confident he was with that, he was just carelessly getting hit with counters and getting tagged with stuff that he seemed to like not even be trying to worry about getting out of the way of. And it ended up with him getting some markings, some blood work going on, and losing. You know, the scorecards were pretty tight when it was stopped, and that's probably about right.
I actually thought they were a little wide, but we'll
yeah,
go on.
He demonstrated a lack of intelligence that caused him to approach the fight in not. You know, it was an entertaining fight, so he could be interviewed and say, "Oh, I did that on purpose to be fun." And fair play if that's the case. But if we're going to be
he's
more
not
cynical,
a he's not Golovkin and his supporters.
If we're going to be more cynical, his confidence and the intelligence he used to approach the fight was lacking. And then if we look at the performance that Charlo put on, where intelligence and being crafty actually did play a point there, I think the clues would be that Charlo should have a big advantage just in that he might approach the fight in a kind of more composed and more strategic way that will see him having some good success.
Okay, first of all, one of the things that I'll just kind of like, the intelligence was lacking if we're under the assumption that he would do that again against a fighter that is better than who Austin Trout was this Saturday. And I think that's completely fair to make that assessment. But, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, maybe he won't. Maybe he'll change. But we've seen it time and time again in the sport where more often than not, when you have those assumptions that a fighter won't do what he did in the past because, oh, the stage is bigger this time, that usually doesn't happen. You know, like you get Arizlan Dilara in a pay-per-view fight and you think, oh, well, here we go. Now we're going to have a fun fight. Not quite.
You look at the track record and what the evidence points to. You know, no one's a fortune teller. You can't be 100% accurate with how things are going to go. You have to look at the clues, and the clues suggest that his ring IQ wouldn't see him in good stead against someone like Charlo.
Yeah, so I also have a different take than you on the fight, and based off of my countering what you just said, you can kind of get the sense that I felt a little differently. So first of all, I was impressed by a couple of things that Herd did. On the whole, what impressed me, and it's kind of funny that I'm going to say this, but I think there were times that Herd showed he can be good defensively. Like, I've seen growth, I guess is what really that is. You know, his defense on Saturday compared to what I've seen in previous fights was actually really good at times, not on the whole. And there were times when Herd did look really good, but I also think Herd is still very raw. And I think Trout knew that, and Trout used every old man trick in the book that he had, and it was kind of like one of those fights where I think this is going to be a big learning fight for Herd, because if you look at all the guys he's fought, he has not fought anybody who brings in the ring intelligence, the experience, etc. That
just a
Austin
bit more
Trout
craftsmanship.
And Herd figured
he's
going
to need it to be a learning fight though, because if he can't fix the holes that should be obvious to him and his team from that fight, then you know, his world stage chances don't look great.
Well, it'll be hard to not see them because he basically fell for every trick. One of the things that I think was to his credit, though, was that I think Herd realized early that he wasn't going to be able to outbox Trout. And it seemed like he wanted to do that in the first round and just realized, wow, I can't outbox this guy. Like, he just decided, I'm going to bulldoze him. And so he walked forward, absorbed punches, ate all the combinations, and you could tell that he knew that Trout couldn't really hurt him, and so he could afford to do this, and he waited until Trout gassed out, and then started to turn the pressure on. Now, Herd definitely is the weakest of the three title holders that were on the card. And you're right that there are some pretty glaring flaws in his game, but the one thing that he has, not the one thing that he has. It's not like this is exclusive to him, but what he has that makes him dangerous is he's got the confidence. He has the intangible confidence and the physicality of a fighter that is really hard to beat. Like, I actually think he will struggle with Charlo, but I actually think he would give Lara a better fight than Charlo because of the way he fights and the way he's willing to take shots. And so
better in the sense of his chances of victory or in terms of fan enjoyment?
Both. I think Herd's the kind of guy that is willing to say, I'm going to get lucky tonight. And I don't care if I lose, but I think I can get lucky if he feels like he can't win a fight, you know, whereas Charlo's going to keep trying different things that aren't going to work. Hurd is the kind of guy that's going to basically empty out the clip on somebody.
I kind of have the opposite take in that I think that Charlo showed himself to be more intelligent and craftier, and I think that's what's going to count against someone who fights the way Lara does.
I don't think so.
I rate Charlo's chances higher just based on his ability to approach fights in a more creative way.
My counter to that is that the guy who gave Lara the most trouble was Alfredo Angulo. Which of the two is more like Alfredo Angulo?
Yeah, you're right on that comparison. Yeah, that's fair.
And you know, Hurd kind of reminded me of Michael Myers in this fight. I know we're close to Halloween, but like he just keeps getting hit. It's just blank face walking forward. No matter what Trout did, it was just like he was there at every corner. Everywhere Trout turned, even if Trout nails him with like 5 punches, Hurd is just still standing there, like just staring at him like, I'm going to knock you out. And, you know, it took like Trout doing everything. Like, I mean, by the end of the fight, Trout looked like he was like, what can I do to this guy? I've done everything. Like, Trout hasn't had an offensive performance like that in years since he fought Miguel Cotto. And he couldn't do anything. So I was really impressed in some ways by Hurd. I still think, like, on paper, Hurd gets schooled by Lara. He gets beaten by Charlo. But he has that wild card to him that the other guys don't have. So now let's talk about Lara and Gache. Another boring fight. But you have a different... Well, you don't have a different take on the boring fight, but I think you have a little rant that you'd like to go on about...
I don't know if it's a rant. I think I was kind of surprised to see everyone talking about the entertainment value lacking and that it was a letdown of a fight in terms of its enjoyability, when that's, you know, that's kind of Lara's bread and butter. He's not known as an exciting guy in terms of the fights he puts on. So... I don't know. I think I went in expecting to be bored, and I got my money's worth.
Look, I don't think we can blame Lara 100%. Is that controversial to say?
Yeah, I think it is controversial to say. I think that when you're in a lot of fights that look that way, it's probably a bit your fault.
Okay, well, at most, I'm willing to give him 50% blame. Because Lara did what he normally does, and he did it beautifully. Very early, if you're watching closely, you can see that Lara took away every bit of Gache's offense. By the third round, or maybe it was the second actually, Gache was done. Like, Gache tried a couple of things. The openings weren't there. Oh, wow, I should have turned the sound off.
What was that? That was very animated.
That was a notification from Town of Salem.
Oh, wow. Okay.
If you don't know, like in our chat, Simon's played this game before too. We all play this browser game called Town of Salem. It's like a werewolf mafia style game where you eliminate people and blah, blah, blah. Back to the fight, though. We could talk about that later. Gache's response to Lara was basically to put up his gloves and stay in his guard. And, like, Lara definitely is a common denominator in a lot of bad fights. But, like, hello, can somebody come up with a game plan? I mean, was Alfredo Angulo the only one that could do it? Really? Did you see him against Canelo? Okay, like, Gache had 2 rounds.
Having to reach back a lot of years to find that, aren't you?
To an entertaining Lara fight?
Yeah, the Angulo fight was, what, 2012? A long time ago.
It was a long time ago. StubHub Center, by the way. That's probably what it was. I mean, really, there was a moment in the second round where Gache, I think you could see him, he reaches out for the jab like he's about to do it and then takes it back. And he says, and you could just see the look on his face like it dawns on him, I can't do that. And you know he wanted to, and there was obviously a game plan. And Jorge Rubio is one of the best trainers in boxing, although his work with Oscar Valdez has not been that impressive this year. But overall, he's been a great trainer. He's got world champions, and there was nothing. So, like, I don't know. Like, there's not much you can say about this fight. Like, do you see anybody at 154 truly posing a threat to Arislandi Lara? And I don't mean in the sense that Well, what I mean is there anybody that you would favor over Lara at 154?
Not by a long stretch, but I actually like, I like Charlo in that fight.
You would favor him?
I think really slightly, yeah.
So, like, basically favor him the way Lara or Charlo was favored over Lubin?
No, I like that, like, quite a lot. So, you know, if we're going to do percentages on it, I'd give, like, Charlo maybe 55%.
Really? Because the line for the Lubin fight was minus 130.
Mm.
So you're saying it would be higher than that or lower?
Well, what the line is versus, like, what we think isn't always going to marry up.
Uh-huh.
You know, Amnat Ruingrong was, like, an 8-1 underdog against Zhu Ximing.
Yep, we all know that one.
And their grandma to bet on him on that one. So yeah, I think that Charlo should have been a much wider, you know, betting favorite in that matchup. But you know, it doesn't always go that way. I think that it would be way closer in my estimations than the previous.
In my opinion, I think Charlo could run into the mistake of trying to think he can box with Lara. And if he did that, I think it'd be a big mistake. And that's why I like Hurd, because I don't think Hurd would even try to box. I mean, Hurd is electric type. Lara's water. He's going to do what electric types do. So I that's why I like Hurd over Lara. But I do not favor either guy. Like, if I was making the money line, if somebody's asking me percentage, like, neither guy is going to get higher than 50% over Lara.
Yeah, and I can see how you get there. I just give Charlo a bit of an edge there.
I mean, I like Charlo as much as the next guy, but I don't see it. Let's move on. We're going to talk about Miguel Cotto now. Actually, no, I have this out of order. There's more to talk about. There's Leo Santa Cruz. He stopped Chris Avalos. And first of all, what a chin on Chris Avalos. I mean, like, the guy refused to go down.
It's one of the ones where I think people were kind of unhappy with the stoppage, certainly in the arena. There was a lot of backlash to it immediately as it happened. But it's like, come on, like, he doesn't have to be physically a corpse for us to know that it's time to put a stop to something.
Yeah, I think Avalos, if like you show him the tape, he would probably be like, yeah, I'm probably done right here. Wow, I can't believe, like, he'll probably say, like, I can't even remember. Like, I can't believe I'm on my feet still. Because he took a
huge
beating.
Huge chin, huge heart, well done to him. It's just, if people are saying that it was a premature stoppage or whatnot, you have to strongly disagree there.
And here's the counter to that, okay? So Chris Avalos is the guy. You see what he brings to the ring. He's a great action fighter. You let him get beat senseless to the point where he's getting dropped on the floor. He doesn't get these opportunities anymore. Now, he's not going to fight in a main event against a Leo Santa Cruz, but there are young up-and-coming guys that you can put him in there with, and he might beat him. But if you let him fight to the point where Santa Cruz is basically bouncing him up off the canvas, Anthony Joshua style, like, Avalos doesn't get to fight anymore. So I think sometimes, especially with a guy like Avalos, if you like him, if you want to see him have future success in life and in his career, you got to want him to get stopped before it's too late. And I think this was a slight bit a little too late because, I mean, he did recover from that, like, I can't remember what round it was, but there was a round where he was basically like, wow, this guy's out on his feet. Mm-hmm. But
that was where I started thinking that it needed stoppage. So it came late, if anything, in my view.
I mean, it might have gotten stopped in that round if they didn't think it was, if they hadn't have stopped the Gutierrez-Mares fight. But even though that went to a decision, like, I think there was a little bit of a, hey, we should let this go a little longer this time so the fans don't kill us.
It'd be interesting to hear whether that sort of thing factors in, because you'd hope it doesn't, but I could see how it might.
Yeah, I think in boxing we always say everybody can be influenced, and I think you know.
It's a shame, because you're never going to get the honest truth, because you're never going to hear someone say that they risk someone's health for the sake of entertainment in such a straightforward manner.
Is Santa Cruz the number one guy at featherweight?
You got other options?
I mean, you're the British person here.
I'm not going to do it. I picked him to beat Frampton in the rematch.
I honestly cannot remember if I picked him or not. So
I picked Frampton winning the first, and then I picked Santa Cruz winning the second.
I think I picked Santa Cruz by knockout, actually. No, I'm kidding. I cannot remember.
okay. little while back. But yeah, I think that you have to give it to him, don't you?
What about Gary Russell?
No.
Do you know who he is?
Yeah, of course. But I think you're probably half joking, but you half are serious at the same time. Where like,
well, obviously we have to discuss it, but like, I don't believe so.
Yeah, I think that he would struggle tremendously in that matchup.
I mean, I think Gary Russell gives him a really good fight, and we'd have to see something different from Santa Cruz. Like Russell's speed.
Entertaining for sure. I'd definitely enjoy seeing it, but I can't. Can you responsibly pick Gary Russell Jr. to win that fight? Is kind of my question.
No. Everything indicates no. Yeah. What do you think about Oscar Valdez?
I don't think that'd necessarily be good.
You think that Santa Cruz would light up Valdez?
I think that it is too premature to say.
What about Jojo Diaz?
No, I don't like his chances.
What about Nonito Donaire? He was sitting ringside. He was sitting ringside.
Well, you know, some people.
I mean, so is Mikey Garcia, but we're obviously not going to get that fight.
You know, like there's fame and crowd appeal, and then there's like accomplishments and recent record, and whether you look competitive based on actual fighting stats or rather than just if fans really like who you are. You know, they're two different things, and so who sat ringside and who they try and put over for a future match doesn't always line up with the person who's necessarily a good match for it.
Would you be willing to see Avalos versus Nonito Donaire?
I would be willing to see that.
That would be a great fight. Let's move on. Abner Mara's got a technical decision over Andres Gutierrez, and there are other featherweights we can go through, by the way. One interesting little fact about featherweight, the top six guys in the division all have a loss. Imagine that.
It's got to be the only division where that's true.
Yeah, I think that's right. I'm running through the divisions. Light flyweight might also have everybody with a loss.
Depends how you class.
I'm just going by BoxRec because it's the easiest thing. Light flyweight.
No, well, yeah, I haven't got light flyweight up. But I'm trying to think just off the top of my head if there's any that do. But yeah, that is uncommon. But it's good. I think that's a good thing to see, if anything.
But it is good because if we love all the matchups that you can make at this division. Like whether you think Santa Cruz is going to blow out Oscar Valdez or whoever, you can't deny that they're all entertaining fights. I mean, Valdez versus Gary Russell, which I'll take Gary Russell.
I think having a loss dynamic adds to, it's more difficult to say that there's people protecting their undefeated record or, you know, complaining about any of that angle.
Yeah, you can't because you're not undefeated.
Yeah, exactly. So I just like what that brings to it.
Abner Mares, he got a technical decision over Andres Gutierrez. I thought this would be a tougher fight for Mares, but Mares continues to look better.
Why did you think it would be tougher, though? Because you've been a fairly big Mares fan for a while.
No, that is absolute nonsense. I've never liked Mares. I have nothing against him other than the fact that I've never been a fan of him.
I just have distinct memories of, on more than one occasion, you saying that his skills and abilities were underrated and that he doesn't get the credit he deserves as being as talented as he is.
If I said that, I'd take it all back because I didn't mean it. I was lying. Literally, I think
you were saying it in reference to the Johnny Gonzalez loss.
Okay, fine. I mean, sure. Like, in a sense, that could be true. If looking back, maybe it's one of those things where a guy loses and like, so let's say Erickson Lubin loses in the first round and everybody's like, well, he was crap from the start. I knew it. He got beat by Jermell Charlo. And it's like,
it was the first round, first of all.
Second of all, Lubin has an excuse. He went from fighting basically a British domestic and then he fights Jermell Charlo, one of the best 154-pound fighters in the world and one of probably the top 20 fighters in the world, period. Like, that's a big jump. Okay, now, Mares, I probably was doing the same thing back then, but like you just cornered me into defending Mares. I've just never been a Mares fan, but it's not like I hate him or anything. It's just I've never been a fan. Like, he low blows too much. I mean, he did, and I'll give it to him. Like, I'll give him all the respect because he's really like, just Robert Garcia's done miracles with him. Just absolute miracles. Like, he looked like a shell, like a guy who needed to retire, and a guy who had no passion in the sport after he lost to Gonzalez and was with Virgil Hunter, who is the fight rebuilder himself, and he failed with Mahrez. Mahrez goes with Robert Garcia and is a completely new man, gets a world title, has a good showing against Leo Santa Cruz, and looks like he's on his way back up. And this rematch looks really interesting now, don't you think? Like, Mahrez has proven that he can box on the outside. Now, I don't like his chances because I think physically his skill set, like, it falls into the trap of what Santa Cruz wants to do. Like, he's not going to get Santa Cruz's respect. And he wouldn't get a guy like Frampton's respect either. And he's going to have to rely on outboxing these guys. And I think both guys are better boxers. That's not to say that Santa or Mahrez isn't good, because he is, but those guys are clearly a class, or not a class, but they're clearly a level above.
Yeah, and good fights, though. Entertainment value is definitely there. There's a lot of matches to be made.
I'd love to see Frampton Mahrez. I think that, like, both guys are the same size. I think that's a fight of the year contender, probably.
Mm. Yeah, it definitely could turn out that way.
Like, Mahrez will willingly lead, and we know that when a guy leads, Frampton can be explosive with his counterpunching ability. And then on the undercard to that, we had a one-round knockout. Eddie Ramirez, he was upset by Antonio DeMarco. First round stoppage. This is also this fight also stopped a little too early to a lot of people. And similar thing with Erickson Lubin. We had a guy, Ramirez, come in. You look a little too confident to me. This guy was like guns blazing, gung-ho, ran right into it. DeMarco has fought this style his whole career, caught him, hurt him, and then finished him. And like, DeMarco getting this win is like, you like to see that. Because if you don't remember, and I don't even fully remember the story, but I know his sister is sick. And like, a while back, there was like this thing on PBC. I think it was before the Barthelemy fight, or maybe it was the Figueroa fight. But basically, they talked about how he keeps fighting for his sister to make money for her treatment or whatever, or to take care of her. So it's nice to see him get a win, and he's got another potential money fight where he can fight, you know, like an Andre Berto or somebody like that, where it's going to be a main event, and they'll use their names to bring people in to watch younger guys on the undercard. But either way, I didn't mind it. Ramirez actually was a decent prospect. He had some solid wins. You know, he'd fought some guys who were undefeated or only had one loss and beat him. So I thought Ramirez would have an easy way with DeMarco, but it just didn't go that way. And this is what happens when you have guys who fight super confident and then they don't know what to do when they're hurt. You don't have much to say on this. I know you don't follow these guys. So
pretty straightforward, though.
We'll change it to something that you do know, and I'll let you talk for a little bit here. George Groves stopped Jamie Cox. Now, I'm going to set you up for this. I'm sure you have your own little thing that you're going to go into, but I want to set you up. So, do you have a concern that about George Groves' defense, given how easily Jamie Cox was landing on him?
I think that I've had that. That's not like a new worry that I've got. So, obviously, he kind of peaked in the public's frame of vision with the Karl Froch double fights from a few years back now. And after he took that loss, he took a rebuilding fight against Rabrassi.
Yes, and looked terrible.
He did, and if you go and check that fight out, as he's going into the 12th round, he gets told in the corner, "You're a million miles ahead on the cards. The only way you can lose this fight is if you go and get tricked into having a brawl and nearly get yourself knocked out. So that's the only thing you definitely don't want to do." And of course, he immediately does just that and goes and has a brawl and takes some heavy shots. He looks okay. It's not like he's in mortal danger, but he gets wobbled by some stuff that he should. Like, it just speaks to someone who is terrifically entertaining but worrying with the way that they approach a fight. And I think that's always going to be the case, that he's always going to, I don't think you can train it or teach out of him. He's always going to be someone that is willing to be in very dangerous positions and puts on explosively entertaining fights. But if the person he's fighting has enough skill and enough power, they're going to find him. He's not someone that can avoid being knocked out, if that makes sense.
Do you think that Cox hurt him?
I don't think he'd say that, and I don't think that he was in, like, Yeah, I guess is the short answer. No, not really is the longer answer.
Okay. Okay, well,
I mean, where people, you could say Hurd was getting hurt in that fight. It wasn't getting badly pressured or anything, but he was definitely feeling the effect of shots that he could have definitely avoided. So, you know, was he hurt? Yeah, probably a bit.
Okay, well, I think there's definitely a concern with Groves because he's completely hittable. I mean, Jamie Cox, like, that guy's footwork was making me nervous watching him. Like, I thought he was going to tip over or trip himself at any point in that fight. And Groves took a while to do anything with him, really. And look, Groves is going to face a guy now who I think is fairly gifted on the offensive end. Chris Eubank Jr. is younger. Mm-hmm. He's more athletic. He's confident. He's faster. He has more hair. He's got a unique attack. I think George Groves is in trouble going forward. Like,
real trouble in this fight. And the reason that, you know, it kind of all the pieces of the puzzle fit together. So I've a lot of times mentioned that I don't think that Eubank Jr. has the best ring IQ. But the things that you do have to praise him for is his work rate and his power. When you combine that with someone like Groves, who's willing to trade and is easily found, if it's someone like Chris Eubank Jr. who's doing the finding, I don't think he's going to end on his feet on that one.
I think the thing that I noticed in this fight was that Groves came out and it looked like he had a specific thing he wanted to do and he was trying to force it, and that stoppage was kind of a fluke because I don't think that's what he wanted to do. I think he was throwing punches, but he was really loading up that right hand. Like, he wanted to do another Carl Froch. He wanted an explosive knockout. And I think if he wouldn't have gotten it, he might have gotten himself into trouble, if not just won a decision. So I think if he comes to do that with Eubank, and for the record, I don't really care for Eubank. Not a fan of him. I think is like their whole little antics and their shtick, their thing is just completely annoying. But I won't deny that Groves is Well, this is a bad matchup for Groves, I think, because, you know, you talk a lot about Eubank's lack of ring IQ. Well, he's fighting George Groves, so there's not going to be that won't be a detriment.
There's few fights that you'll ever feel really confident on the outcome, but I feel really confident of a stoppage there.
Okay, time to move on. Anthony Joshua time. Simon, I know you're excited. Settle down. So... he's not going to fight Kubrat Pulev. Kubrat Pulev has apparently suffered some sort of injury, shoulder injury.
It's all been kind of sketchy, hasn't it? Because we've heard his comments about how he wished he had a couple of more weeks to train. Some people took that to mean that it was hints at foul play and that his cycles were wrong and he was going to get found out on, you know, anti-doping. I didn't think that. I thought it spoke to someone who was nervous. So a while back when we discussed that matchup, I suggested that looked like someone with a losing mentality going into it. So the injury could be them finding a way out, if that makes sense, just giving themselves an excuse not to have to go through with something that they don't rate their chances at.
You're positing that Kubrat Pulev's not fighting Anthony Joshua, and he's saying he's lying about being injured because he's scared of fighting Joshua.
Not quite. I think that he will probably take that fight eventually because it's a good payday, but I think that he's bargaining with himself where he thinks, I can't win this yet. Because rather than admit to himself, I can't win this, he can make excuses for himself. If I just do this, this, and this, that's when I'll actually have a good chance of winning this fight. And it's a kind of like... psychological trick we sometimes use on ourselves to convince us of something that spares our feelings about something.
So are you suggesting that Pulev's gonna wait till maybe he turns 37 years old and then he'll have a better shot at beating the 27-year-old Anthony Joshua?
Gonna need to pull the trigger, take that loss, take that payday, and get done with that soon, or the chance is gonna evade him.
Or has beating the murderer's row of Kevin Johnson, Sam Peter, and Derek Chisora over the past 12 months, is that what he needs to do? He needs another three opponents like that?
I think that it was silly to not go ahead, and if his injury was exaggerated, then that's a very bad decision. a bad strategy. But it's all speculation because we don't know the truth of the matter.
So
but it's a shame.
But it sounds like you're accusing him of being scared at the moment.
Kind of, yeah.
Okay.
Not so much like scared in the sense of like I don't want to fight him ever, but in the sense of I think that he's making up scenarios where he can lie to himself about his chances and that the timing wasn't right for him to feel competitive rather than having to admit that he's worried about his chances in general.
But those would be all justifications for his fear, which ultimately that's what it's boiling down to, is that he's scared of Anthony Joshua. And if you look at Anthony Joshua and how humble he is, I can't imagine why you wouldn't think you wouldn't fear him.
You're doing a number here, but like I'm going to stick to my guns. I think that he wants to make up excuses in his head for when he'll feel that he has a good chance of winning, rather than admit that he never had a good chance of winning and will never have a good chance of winning, because that damages your own ego. And so instead he's saying, I will have a good chance of beating him. It just has to be at a later date. And so that's where I think they're going for the time being.
I have some bad news for Pulev. He's never going to get a Joshua fight. He will never get Joshua fight. They will never make that fight again.
What informs that decision? Because whilst I think that that could be the case, it's not as if... Joshua makes a fortune when he fights. He's got a huge following, does great numbers, and the amount of opponents out there that they can make isn't great. It's not like they've got the luxury of immense choice. There's some notable big ones they want to go for.
I disagree with that. I think
you think there's lots of fish.
I think that there's a guy who we call Deontay Wilder out there.
Yeah, I think there's a Joseph whale, Parker. Like,
there's the winner of Bellew, David Hay.
There's some. You're going for the obvious ones, but who do they pick when they want a less challenging fight?
I don't think there are less challenging fights anymore for Joshua. They're going to pick whoever they can get now. Whoever is going to bring in the most money. And I think, I would be shocked if they said, well, let's give Kubrat Pulev a try, because we took forever to make the fight with him in the first place, and now let's try to see what he can do to get into the ring this time. I think they're just like, you know what, go fight Alexander Povetkin, okay? You want a big fight, fight Povetkin.
I wouldn't bet the farm on that fight never happening. I still think that there's a good chance that it could.
And Joshua could easily get himself knocked out by Deontay Wilder next year, so you know that could be all up in the air.
Or Carlos Takam.
Listen, that's what we're going to talk about now. Is this fight any less competitive now that Carlos Takam is filling in?
Yeah, I think so.
Really?
Yeah.
You actually gave Kubrat Pulev a chance?
No, I think he's more competitive than Takam.
So are we talking 5% versus 0% now?
I mean, we are in that region, yeah.
This is not a competitive fight, okay? Takam, his last three fights, he lost to Joseph Parker. He beat Marcin the Ripper Rakovic, I think he is. He's from somewhere. He was only 17-4, too. Only four losses, and three of those came in his last four fights. And then he fights Ivica Bakurin, who you may remember went like 10 rounds with Tony Bellew. And then he got knocked out in two by Carlos Takam. So maybe you're right. Maybe Takam has like 1% chance. I don't think so, though.
This kind of comes down to the old adage of everyone's got a puncher's chance. He could get lucky. It's the heavyweight division. Anything could happen. One punch can change the fight. All of those things are true, but they're always very slim chances.
Do you know how tall Carlos Takam is?
He's not a big man, is he?
He's 6'1.5". Do you know how tall Anthony Joshua is?
Is he 6'8"?
No, seven? He's not. No, he's not Tyson Fury.
6'6"?
He's 6'6".
Yeah.
That's not going to go well. Not going to go well at all. Anthony Joshua.
What does he usually weigh in at, Takam? Is he a, like, 220 boy?
No, he's a 240, 250. He's all over the place, so that tells you. But he weighs less than Joshua typically.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a guy who's 6'1", weighs a few pounds less than Anthony Joshua. Oh boy, this is not going to be competitive at all. I could be wrong. I could look like a fool when we record this. And the fight's in 2 weeks. It's in 2 weeks, and I won't. Well, I got to figure out how to watch it live. I won't be able to watch it live.
Why? Oh, because of your travel. Yeah.
Yeah. this will be the first Joshua fight I don't watch live. I think
presumably
at this point.
It's on daytime here on HBO.
Yeah, it's on daytime here in HBO. It's a nighttime in the UK, so I'm not quite sure what time that means for China.
For China, it's going to be Sunday morning. We looked it up for you, didn't we? It's going to be about 6 to 7 a.m. on Sunday morning.
I can't remember, but that can work. Let's not.
I rate your chances. But yeah, I do. I rate your chances of watching it higher than I rate Takam's chance of winning it.
Being the person who's probably not going to be able to watch it live and who doesn't really know, I'm not happy about that. Like, that makes me not really care about this fight. I guess we should move on, though.
It's difficult to get you know, super invested in a fight that is like a last-minute replacement. It's very rarely the best event, but sometimes a last-minute heavyweight replacement can lead to a really interesting fight. So I wouldn't abandon all hope.
Do you think that that translates to the 154-pound division? Because Miguel Cotto, in his last fight as a professional boxer, will fight Saddam Ali. Saddam Ali.
Mm-hmm.
How do you rate Ali's chances?
It's kind of dependent on how Cotto looks, because it's Saddam Ali isn't a terrible fighter by any stretch. He's skilled. I've followed him for quite a while and been a fan of him. It's a big skill gap in terms of the experience and the pedigree, but the age could well be a big deal, you know. It's 100% dependent on Cotto losing it rather than Ali winning it. I think
Ali wasn't very good at 147. I mean, he fought most of his career, but when he started to step up, like, he wasn't very good. I mean, when you get stopped by Jesse Vargas, that's saying something, okay? Jesse Vargas. And then you go and you're going to fight Miguel Cotto, a guy who's been comfortably fighting at 154, 155 pounds for a while now, and a guy who's, like, really grown into that division, at least given the opponents that he's been given. And I think this is not a good fight, and I think the real story here is that Golden Boy somehow were trying to get a big name in the ring with Cotto for his last fight. They tried Mikey Garcia, they tried Errol Spence, and they said no. And the reason why, if you don't know why Garcia and Spence turned the fight down with Cotto, which you would think on paper, that's the biggest fight you're ever going to get in your career, possibly. Why would you say no? Well, Golden Boy smartly said, well, we'll let you have the fight with Cotto, but you have to sign a multi-year, multi-fight agreement with us. And Mikey and Spence said, no, thank you. So, I think it was smart, because what does Spence gain from beating Cotto? I don't think he gains that much. Cotto's name doesn't really carry much weight in boxing anymore. I mean, if you saw the Kamigai fight, you'll know Cotto's name don't really mean that much anymore. And then
I think that there is a contingent that think he's the man, like, that really massively still into him. So I think that he gets some credit for winning that fight, but you're right, it's not a fan pleaser across the board for everyone.
I disagree. I don't think Spence gains much from beating Cotto. I think if you look at Cotto fighting on HBO, not doing the greatest numbers anymore, and Spence continually doing big numbers wherever he fights, I think Spence might have surpassed Cotto at this point in their careers. And as far as Mikey Garcia goes, I think Mikey was smart to project the fight. I think if it was at 154, Mikey'd be pushing his luck a little. And I know Mikey is good and skilled, and I wouldn't say that he would lose the fight, but I think he'd just be pushing his luck. And I wouldn't want to see Mikey get into a fight where he's basically lost because of weight and not skill.
I can respect those justifications.
Let's move on to the previews. You're going to have to do some of the heavy lifting here, because I don't really care. To discuss Josh Warrington versus Dennis Salon.
See, I'm in a position where I've got my family visiting this weekend, so I'm likely not going to be able to see much of what's going on. They're all flying over from the UK to visit.
This Saturday.
Yeah, that's right, this weekend.
So you don't care to see Josh 26-0 with 5 knockouts fight?
The card looks like it could be fun, but it's not not a big fanfare type deal. It's a cool domestic card that should be a bit of fun.
I was wrong with this record. It's 25-0 with 5 knockouts. What did I say? 26 with 5 knockouts?
Yeah, it's close.
Oh, that was close. Jezreel Corrales will headline an HBO card. Can you believe that? Jezreel Corrales, the guy who stopped Takashi Uchiyama, then almost lost to him in the rematch, and then performed pretty poorly in his last fight out against Robinson Castellanos. He will fight Golden Boy's Puerto Rican prospect. They're big punching, but doesn't really punch prospect, Alberto Machado. I'm guessing you're not that familiar with both guys.
No.
Okay, here's what you need to know. Machado has, you want to talk about low ring IQ, I think this is the guy, okay? This is a guy that has some pop for, you know, everybody's got pop when you're a good prospect against these guys that you're supposed to beat. But I think that there's definitely a limit to, I guess what I'm trying to say is there's a ceiling for sure that he has. And I think he's already approaching it. And Machado, just in his last fight, did not impress me whatsoever. He won a pretty wide decision. And if I remember correctly, I don't think he really deserved to win it as wide as it was. And now he's going to step up big against Jezreel Corrales. And Corrales, like, on paper, or no, not paper, but he has some skills that are just, like, next level. And then he also has...
I've seen more of him through his Uchiyama fights.
And he does some things that are just, like, fantastic. And then he's got other things just like, wow. Like, he can't take a punch for one. And I think that's what they're hoping, is that Machado can connect with him and drop him or hurt him or something. I don't see it happening, though. Like, Machado just seemed kind of one-dimensional in the fight. So I think Corrales retains here. Machado takes his first loss. Corrales probably wins by a decision. On the undercard, we have Demetrius Andrade making his return. And he will fight Alantes Fox. Now, I said earlier that I thought Andrade is overrated. So I think I'll explain what I mean by that now. So Andrade got a lot of fanfare over what he did to Brian Rose. But did you hear the two key words there? Brian Rose, okay? Mm. Brian Rose robbed, or was the winner of a robbery fight over, was it Luciano Cuello? I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
You remember that. Or no, it was Javier Maciel. You remember that fight. He got
the split decision. Do you remember that fight?
It was the night that...
UK card, wasn't it?
Yeah, Samir Munamini, I think, got his first ever knockout. No, it wasn't Munamini. It was Warrington, actually. Was it Warrington?
Oh, was it the card where Warrington had the...
No, that was a different card. He got his first knockout or whatever. No. It was the Kell Brook-Senchenko fight. I can't remember. There was something on the undercard. I know Joshua fought on the undercard. I can't remember what it was. I guess that was the Munamini fight was a different one. That was when Warrington stopped him.
I can tell you, it was on the Senchenko fight with Kell Brook, and then on the undercard was Callum Smith, who stopped Acosta, and it was the Adam Etches fighting Alexandre Mendrez fight.
Thrilling stuff. Well, so moving on. So Demetrius Andrade destroys Brian Rose, but again, Brian Rose, not that good. Then, but prior to that, he won a world title. Now, how did he win that world title? Well, he won the world title by winning a split decision over Vonis Martirosyan. And if he hadn't have been knocked down, that would have been a draw. Because only one card had him widely winning. The other two had it. One card had it even, and the other one had Martirosyan winning. So then he goes off and takes a long break from boxing, over a year. Then he comes back and he fights Willie Nelson, and he looks all right. Drops him a few times, looks all right. And then he has a split decision win last year against Jack Colque, which was a really bad fight for Andrade. I mean, Andrade looked like Colque was getting to him and on the verge of maybe pulling off the upset towards the end. I mean, Colque got the decision on one of the cards. Mm-hmm. And on the other two cards, it was 8-4 for Andrade. So Andrade, I think, gets this fanfare as being this guy who's, you know, can possibly beat Golovkin and all this stuff, but I don't see it.
Yeah, so it sounds like your take is that he's someone that's record's fine, but has looked sketchy against not always the best level of opponent and not won as convincingly as you'd expect someone to if you want to be talking about them as this big contender in the division.
Yeah, and so now we're going to have him come in, and he's going to fight Alantes Fox, who is undefeated. He's got 23 wins, no losses. He has one draw. and he's going to get schooled by Andrade, and everybody's going to think, wow, Andrade's great.
Do you think, well, I mean, yeah, it's going to be the hype magic, isn't it?
Exactly. This is the HBO, like, trademark move. We put them in with somebody who looks really good on paper. So, say, like, Nicholas Walters against Miguel Moriaga, although that didn't go that great. But you do a fight like that, and everyone thinks, wow, he's so great. And it's like, yeah, but that guy actually wasn't that good. Now we're only looking at records. And it's, you know, that's one of the problems in boxing, is that people only look at records. But it's easy, because a lot, that's what casual fans do. They look at records, because it's a lot easier to look at a record, look at somebody's BoxRec page, than look up the YouTube fights and spend 3 hours just watching 5-6 fights of what a guy's done to actually form an informed opinion.
Yeah, eye test versus the credentials test.
So that's the HBO card. I think there's actually another card. Let me just double, or another fight, sorry. No, there's not.
You missed, and it must have been by accident, because I know you'd have mentioned it. There's Tyrone Nurse, I think.
I don't care. Like, okay.
Fighting Jack Catt, I think.
Jack Catterall? I like Catterall, by the way. But it's only out of protest of Nurse that I'm not mentioning him. Jack Catterall is going to beat him, though. Just so you know, he's going to beat him. Like, Catterall was brought in as a sparring partner for Floyd Mayweather. Okay, that tells you of the kind of skill that people see in Catterall. Okay, so that's our Tyrone Nurse, Jack Catterall. What do we call it? Preview. Then we're going to talk about Murat Gassiev, the 24-year-old cruiserweight champion. This is part of the World Boxing Super Series. He's going to fight Christoph Volderchek, I think is how you say the name.
I've been having a tough time catching these live.
Because they're not
they
on
don't
TV.
Seem to be on TV.
Oh,
yeah,
do you have DirecTV? What is up with...
No, I've got... what even have I got? Comcast, maybe?
Yeah, so it's on the Audience Network. But if not, you can stream it on the World Boxing Super Series website.
Go and use a computer for it. It's a shame that they've not put it on any television station that I can get.
Well, they were planning to put it on a TV station, but they just couldn't. They didn't get it good enough. I mean, Showtime said. This might have been off the record, but basically that there was no interest in the early rounds of this tournament because of, you know, nobody knows who Christoph Volderchek is. I mean, the guy's lost 3 times. Who's he been beaten by? No one knows.
But it's broadcast free on the internet. You would have thought that they could have negotiated a very competitive price, like.
With YouTube or something. I mean, Frank Warren is putting fights on YouTube.
Like, it's kind of baffling. But extra annoying is that the website that they stream it from encodes it in such a way that my PlayStation can't even stream it. So I'd have to come and use the PC instead, which I suppose I'll end up doing. Or watching it not live.
Yeah, I mean, this one I don't think is going to be very long. I think Gassiev's going to beat Volderchek pretty easily. Volderchek's, you know... 36 years old. He's getting up there. Every time he's stepped up, it seems like he's been stopped.
Or, when did we last properly see him? Was it the draws fight stopped. A few years back?
Yeah, the draws fight. I don't think he's been stopped, but like he loses every time he steps up. And he mostly fights domestically in Poland. So I'm pretty sure that we're going to see Gassiev stop this guy.
Hmm.
Another British fight we can talk about. Ryan Burnett is going to fight Zanat Zakyanov. Now, do you know anything about Ryan Burnett?
It's not a name that rings a bell with me. Where would I know them from?
He beat Lee Haskins for the title, I believe. Or was it Stewie Hall? One of those guys. They all kind of just meld together. I think I'm pretty sure it was Lee Haskins because Stewart Hall was like 115.
Fair enough.
Either way, this is a unification fight. Zanat Zakyanov, you may remember, he's the one that beat Rashid Warren in his last fight. And Zakyanov, I knew was going to win that fight. Just knew he was gonna win that fight. It was the fight where Warren dropped him in the first round. It looked like he was gonna stop him, and then basically did nothing else later on in the fight. And so he's gonna unify with Brian Burnett, and my guess is that he's gonna beat Burnett as well. I think Burnett has the wrong style for him.
That's interesting. I wonder how that compares to the line, because all of the clues show Burnett being able to win this one. So,
I wonder what
betting odds are.
What are the clues? Beating British domestic fighters?
with that combined with how are we saying this, Zakianov?
Yeah.
He got kind of handled, didn't he, against Roshi Warren, and Warren kind of threw it.
Well, Warren had like one or two good rounds at the beginning, and then basically,
but they weren't just good rounds; they were smoke rounds.
One was for sure. But it was a good fight. The next day is going to be Hassan and Dom. This will be in Japan. Ooh, I might be able to watch this. Oh, Hassan and Dom is going to rematch Ryota Murata for, I think it's a WBA middleweight title. It doesn't matter because Golovkin's a real champion of the middleweight division. Hassan and Dom is going to fight Ryota Murata. The first time around, it was controversial. A lot of people thought Ryota Murata won the fight. And somehow, in his hometown, the decision went to Hassan and Dom. Wonder what happened there. So they'll rematch.
What are you saying?
I don't know. I just think that people love Ryota Murata and think he's something he's not. So, of course, they were like, oh, why did Hassan and Dom get the decision? Must be a robbery. So that's what I think. But whatever. I don't think Murata's that great. I think...
Do you think it's going to go the same way and get scored similarly? Or
I have no clue how this is going to go, actually. I'm not too sure. I don't know what to make of Murata. I just know he's not that great. I know he's not world level, but I don't know what he is. You know, I don't know if he's domestic. I don't know if he's
green.
Like,
is what he is early, isn't he?
Well, I mean, the dude is kind of old now. I think he's like 29. I could be wrong, but he might be 29.
Prolate.
How old is he?
So he's 31.
Okay, so he was 29 2 years ago, is what I meant to say.
Turned pro in 2013.
So. Yeah, so he's been a pro for 4 years now, and the dude's got 12 fights. Like. You don't. What are you fighting two times a year for? You're supposed to be hungry. And it's not like he made massive steps up in every step or every step of the way. So weird one there. I think Hassan and Dom can beat him again. The guy's crafty, but I'm just not too sure. The undercard has Ken Shiro versus Pedro Guevara in a light flyweight title fight. I don't know too much about Ken Shiro, to be honest with you guys. I know Pedro Guevara is actually pretty good. Shiro's another Japanese prospect who's got 10 fights and is basically walking into a title fight. And we've seen how that goes. It's like 50-50 for these guys.
Coin toss when... I don't know. You throw them in at the deep end, I guess, and they either swim or they sink.
Yeah. And he did well so far. In his last fight, he beat Gonigan Lopez, I think it was. Yeah, it was Gonigan Lopez. And then who beat Triangle Theory, Lopez, beat Guevara. So Ken Shiro, now the champion, will fight Guevara. So I don't know who's going to win this fight. Daigo Higa, this is the fight you need to watch, okay? Daigo Higa is one of the best prospects in the sport right now. I believe he has a world title now. I think he won a world title in his last fight. Either way, this guy's like an action fighter. He's like the kind, like, Daigo Higa looks like he basically learned to box, and he learned the proper way of how to box, but his style that he really liked was like the Ruslan Provodnikov all the way to the Mike Tyson, like everything in between. He liked that, and that's how he's modeled his style. So it's a come forward action style where he likes to fight on the inside. He'll defend against Thomas Masson, who I wonder where this guy's from. It says he's from France, a French flyweight. And those will be the fights for this week. Anyone stick out to you that you're particularly excited for?
It's not a big ticket name weekend. I think Zaki Obika's out that you'd missed, so you know,
really, sure we're going to talk about Saki Obika?
No.
Shout out to you, Graham. Saki Obika.
Gassiev fight will be interesting, and I quite like the Jack Catterall fight.
So are your feelings hurt that I just skipped over it?
No. I'm not emotionally invested. I just think that could be an interesting one, because it's one of those ones where you're just seeing a bit more of somebody and getting to start to feel a pulse for what their skill ceiling is going to be.
Yeah, you're right. Our friend Saki Obika will be fighting again this week. His opponent only has 16 losses, too.
Yeah, that's a shining record to come in with.
That's an upgrade over his last opponent, who had 5 losses.
I bet.
Saki Obika has never fought a guy with or he hasn't fought a guy with more than 16 losses since 2003. This is going to be a good one. All right. Well, thanks for listening this week. We'll be back very soon. We're actually going to do another podcast this week. I'm going to try to get Jason on, but Jason's complaining. He's at home saying he's got a toothache and stuff, and I told him to suck it up, but he wasn't having it. So
I feel like I lost Jason to the void. It's been ages since I've spoken with him, which is a shame.
He's busy pretending like he has a life. Yeah, he texts me about boxing and is like, what has he been saying recently? I was talking to him about George Groves today. You know his feelings on George Groves.
I actually can't recall. What are they?
He hates George Groves.
And I can't. Why is that?
He's going bald. I don't know.
just guttural.
No, I don't know why. I think George Groves just really annoys him. I think he's hated him since the Frotch fight. The way George Groves is all like arrogant, thinking he's gonna knock out Frotch, and then he couldn't finish up, and blah blah blah. So, anyway, we'll be back with a different type of episode in a couple of days. I got to do it before we leave. I'm leaving on Thursday. So, thanks for listening. Do leave ratings, reviews, share. Oh man, I forgot Leo wrote me a script for what I'm supposed to read at the beginning and the end of the podcast. I'll have to tell him I'm sorry that I didn't do it. Well,
that is a silky smooth segue right there. That's why you get paid the big bucks.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on, Simon. I got to go talk to Leo now.